pays to be vaccinated contest, your COVID-19 vaccination could pay off big time. Every Friday in August, you could win $150,000 and two scholarships of $10,000. Plus, if you've had both shots September 3rd, there's a draw for 16 scholarships of $20,000 and a jackpot of $1 million. Register now for the It Pays to be Vaccinated contest at quebec.ca/vaccination contest. The sooner you're vaccinated, the faster you can take part. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Juan Gonzalez. We go now to occupied East Jerusalem and the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, where Palestinian families are trying to block Jewish settlers from forcibly expelling them from their own homes. On Monday, the Israeli Supreme Court offered a deal to four of the Palestinian families facing eviction. They could stay in their homes for now if they begin paying rent to a Jewish settlement organization, which claims ownership over the disputed properties. The Palestinian families rejected the deal, insisting they were the legal owners. The Israeli Supreme Court has not yet set a date for its final ruling. The United Nations has described the planned evictions as a possible war crime. UN Rights Office spokesperson Rupert Colville said in May, quote, "The occupying power cannot confiscate private property in occupied territories." Well, we're joined now by Mohammed El-Kurd, a Palestinian writer and poet who's organizing to save his family's home in Sheikh Jarrah. He was in the courtroom on Monday. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Mohammed. Could you describe what happened Monday in the court, what the proceedings were like, and what the response to the deal has been?
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. The court hearing at the Israeli Colonial Supreme Court was like any other hearing we've had, except for the massive amount of press outside the court hall. Essentially, what happened is that we were in a courtroom that was speaking only in Hebrew, and we do not speak Hebrew. Most of us that live in Sheikh Jarrah do not speak Hebrew, so we were there playing a game of broken telephone, trying to decipher what is being said. But we understood that the Supreme Court is evading its responsibilities. The court is really aware of the international media pressure. They even explicitly made a remark about the media pressure. And so they wanted to reach a quote-unquote diplomatic solution. And so they're evading their responsibilities, pressuring us to reach a settlement with the settlers instead. Now, the way this is being reported or the way this is being conveyed might sound like a good deal, but what's happening here is that we would be living at the mercy of settlers, paying rent to live in our own homes, and dealing with all kinds of arbitrary policies. I imagine I personally don't love the idea of having a landlord, let alone having a settler landlord.
And Mohammed, could you go a little bit for our listeners and viewers who don't know the story of the history of your home going back to actually to 1956? And you wrote in an article in The Nation last summer that your grandmother, who was an icon of Palestinian resistance, was one of the original people who settled in that particular home.
Yeah, absolutely. My grandmother was among 27 other families that were forcibly expelled from their homes in the 1948 Nakba upon the establishment of what is called the State of Israel on Palestinian lands through ethnic cleansing. And so they were made refugees, and they went from city to city, and they found themselves in Jerusalem. The United Nations, alongside the Jordanian government, decided to build Sheikh Jarrah, the units of Sheikh Jarrah, as a refugee project to house them. Unfortunately, both of these entities never fulfilled their promises of transferring the land ownership to the Palestinian refugees because of the Nakba in 1967, because of the war with the Israeli forces. And so in the 70s, you began seeing Israeli settler organizations largely registered in the United States and funded by private donors in the United States claiming our property. Now, to understand this, you have to understand the larger picture that almost every neighborhood in occupied Jerusalem is facing the same threat of NGOs, settler NGOs that are fabricating documents and using an inherently biased judicial system, an inherently colonial judicial system to expel Palestinians. So you have a partnership here between the settler organizations and the state to expel Palestinians from Sheikh Jarrah. And this is exactly what's happened in Sheikh Jarrah since 1972. This has been 49 years of postponement and delays and court cases. So I think it's really important for people that are listening to understand that the punishment is not just in the act of the expulsion. The punishment is the process itself. It's losing your youth, losing your hope, losing the prospects of your future to the lingering threat of homelessness at all times. And this reality is not just for people in Sheikh Jarrah, it's a reality for hundreds of thousands of Palestinians all across Palestine.
And in terms of what is your hope in terms of the still to be the ruling to come from the Israeli court?
I would like to see the court make a ruling. I dare the court to make a ruling. You know, I know that these judges, these so-called justices, have been evading their responsibility of making a ruling because they have a reputation in the legal world. They have universities to go and give talks to Yale and Harvard, and they have places where they have to hold their head up high. But I would like them to make a ruling. Not that I ever expect that any ruling that would come from an Israeli court be in my favor or in the favor of Palestinians, because as we know, it is fundamentally colonial and biased against Palestinians. But I would like them to take their own actions. I am not going to settle. I am not going to compromise. I am not going to pay for my own dispossession. I would like them to confront the possible, like the potential international ramifications for their actions.
And Mohammed, could you say a little bit more about the judges on this case? You pointed out in one of your tweets that Noam Solberg, one of the judges, himself lives in a settlement in the occupied West Bank.
Yeah, I mean, he's also not the only one of the Supreme Court justices that live in internationally recognized occupied territories. This is a system that does not care about international law, that does not care about the way it looks. You know, this is the High Court of Justice. It's in the name. This is the High Court of Justice, and it is erected on the rubble of land stolen from Palestinians. This system, this entire system, can never be in favor of Palestinians, nor can it ever be able to deliver justice to Palestinians here in Jerusalem.
And could you explain, Mohammed, the ongoing repression in Sheikh Jarrah as we speak, and the role of these settler organizations, in particular Nahalat Shimon, involved in this case?
Absolutely. You know, you had me, Amy had me on here a month or two ago, and I was talking about a blockade, an illegal blockade, where Israeli occupation forces blockaded our neighborhood and suppressed our children and tear gassed us and beat us with batons and threw skunk water at our homes. And this is very much still the reality. Just yesterday, we had to deal with a lot of Israeli occupation Israeli occupation forces repressions in Sheikh Jarrah. What's really interesting, and it's not just an anomaly, in Sheikh Jarrah is the clear and explicit and unabashed partnership that takes place between the police forces, the soldiers, and the settlers, where they combine their efforts and collude to repress Palestinians. We've seen this in the West Bank, where Israeli settlers and soldiers work together to kill Palestinians, and we saw The Intercept even do a report on it, and we're seeing this every single day in Sheikh Jarrah, where settlers can just point at which Palestinians they'd like to see repressed or brutalized by the Israeli police officers, and exactly they do the same. I mean, I will tell you, I had a journalist come into the neighborhood a few months ago, and I was telling her all kinds of things about this being a partnership and this being apartheid and the treatment that settlers get, and she didn't believe me until a settler pointed at her, and then boom, she was asked to leave the neighborhood, forced to leave the neighborhood, actually, and then she believed me. So it's really important to point out that when we say the system is made up of settlers, this manifests materially. This is a system built by settlers to expel Palestinians, and in every avenue it takes place, it's doing just that, serving settler supremacy, working to expel Palestinians.
And Mohammed, you tweeted that while you were in the courtroom, Israeli soldiers stormed into homes in the neighborhood?
Yes, while we were in the courtroom, the majority of the neighborhood actually went to the Supreme Court to support our families. And because we do this as a community, we do this as a neighborhood. And while we were outside, the Israeli forces raided three of our neighbors' homes. One of the homes actually is my friend's, Murad Atiyah's. His aunt is disabled and she's elderly, and they did not care to wake her from her sleep. They did not care to disrupt her, to horrify her in her bedroom, with, you know, saying that there are rioters hiding. I'm wondering where the rioters could be.
And Mohammed, the Times of Israel reported that the Israeli government was in fact hoping to postpone this hearing in a bid to assuage the Biden administration, which has opposed the evictions. So your response to that, and also the fact that Israel's new prime minister, Naftali Bennett, is expected to arrive in the U.S. later this month for his first state visit and meeting with President Biden, what do you expect to happen during that meeting?
I mean, it's really clear that Sheikh Jarrah and the battle against Israeli ethnic cleansing has won in terms of the international media landscape. We have won. The fact that there were over 100 journalists awaiting our return from the courtroom yesterday exemplifies that we have won. And so the Israeli government is terrified of taking action against the community here in Sheikh Jarrah. I say this, however, knowing that this is a regime that have behaved for decades and decades, for seven decades, with such impunity, has massacred and murdered and stolen lands and annexed illegally for decades and decades, and did so with such impunity that I worry that international outrage or diplomatic concerns might not deter it from doing this. I, like everybody else, I watch this from my couch and I wait to see what happens. But I will say that the general sentiment in Sheikh Jarrah, alongside the anxiety and sleeplessness, is the fury that our fate, our destiny, is in the hands of colonizers, is at the mercy of laws that were made by colonizers to serve colonizers.
And Mohammed, very quickly before we conclude, you've said, and you've said again now, that you have no faith in the judicial process, but what you do have faith in is the kinds of protests that have happened all across the world. As you just said, that Sheikh Jarrah has already won. Could you talk about what you'd like to see happen on the streets from people across the EU and especially here in the U.S., the countries that that have previously given unconditional support to the Israeli state?
I would like to see politicians and policymakers be loyal to the wishes of their constituents, to the people who live in their countries. It's very clear that the people of the world, the tide is turning, the dam has already cracked, and people are in support of Palestinian liberation and decolonization. And it's just about time that this support manifests materially, that boycotts, divestments, and sanctions be implemented, that people take onto the streets and continue taking onto the streets, because this cannot sustain. This system of apartheid, of settler colonialism, of military occupation is just not sustainable. And the Israeli government must be stopped before the entire Palestinian population is wiped out.
My name is Ido Conrad. I'm here with Amjad Iraqi, my co-host and co-editor at the magazine. Every month we bring you the stories that you just won't hear anywhere else.
So this is a story that you might have actually heard about. In rather odd news, the ice cream company Ben & Jerry's has basically been blitzing through the headlines across Israel, Palestine, and in the United States about a recent decision that it just made last week. Basically announcing that they will no longer be selling their Ben & Jerry's ice cream in what they defined as the occupied Palestinian territories, which basically means that they don't want to be selling their ice cream in Israeli settlements located on occupied land.
Exactly. And this decision has led to just a total uproar by Israeli politicians, Jewish Israeli politicians across the political spectrum, really from the far right and to the Zionist left. Surprisingly, you know, I was taken aback by how uniform and unanimous the response was, and not just how uniform it was, but really almost how verbally caustic it was and full of like anger and rage. Everyone was kind of surprised by, you know, the fact that the President of Israel, Isaac Herzog, called it a form of terrorism. The foreign minister, Yair Lapid, who will be prime minister, set to be prime minister after Naftali Bennett, called it an anti-Semitic move and vowed to basically go to the various states in the United States that have passed anti-BDS legislation over the past few years and ensure that they sanction Ben & Jerry's over this decision. This is just wild watching this. Over a decision that, you know, is essentially trying to comply with very kind of basic tenets of international law. And in the eyes of some people actually says, oh, this is what Israel claims to stand for. They claim to stand for a two-state solution. And Ben and Jerry's is just saying, this is not part of Israel. This is occupied territories. So I'm taken aback by this. I'm wondering how you're watching this all unfold. Where do you land on this?
I always feel like I'm kind of caught on two different sides of this. Like on the one hand, I'm sure at face value, this story seems ridiculous. And that the reaction that you were just describing from all these top Israeli officials is an overreaction to be kind and just flat out crazy on another side. But the more we kind of thought about this, and we've discussed this quite a bit, it's that the more we kind of unpack this story, which again looks very strange on the surface, it actually raises a lot of themes, a lot of questions. And in the end, the story is actually quite important. And even though it's weird, we're dedicating an entire episode to it, we actually think there's quite a few bits that we want a lot of our listeners to kind of understand and to engage with and to understand like why this could actually be a very important and memorable moment in the history of, you know, Israel-Palestine, as much as it is a footnote, but that it does mark a really important signifier of where the struggle for equality, justice, and freedom for Palestinians is moving towards.
Yeah, I agree. And I think there was a lot of sarcasm on social media over the last few weeks, I think, or the last week. People who, you know, were saying this is, who cares, this is an ice cream company, this doesn't matter, or like that's, you know, kind of the best version of it is like this doesn't really matter, what difference is this going to make. People on both kind of sides of the political spectrum saying these kinds of things, and you know, I actually think it's a watershed moment. It's a watershed moment particularly because it kind of encapsulates a few trends that are taking place in this particular moment on Israel-Palestine. Whether it's, you know, the relationship between American Jews and Israel, or the future of the BDS movement, all of these kinds of things are kind of coming to a head right now in a really, really interesting way.
So, Ido, I'm wondering if you could tell us actually a bit more, what do these politicians' reactions tell us about what the Israeli political establishment sees and how it understands these settlements in the territories?
Well, I mean, I think that on paper, a lot of the people that responded to this so vociferously, such as Yair Lapid and Isaac Herzog, they believe in a two-state solution. They say, you know, whether it's going to happen now or whether it'll happen someday in the future, Yair Lapid just, you know, actually delivered a speech in which he said it's not going to happen in the foreseeable future, but at least on paper, he and his party, Yesh Atid, and much of the rest of the Zionist left and the center are committed to this idea of a two-state solution, which, you know, the Ben and Jerry's decision kind of falls squarely within that realm. But I think there's a few things happening here. There's something that's happening on a psychological level, like a mass psychological level, which has to do with the last few years in Israeli politics, and particularly the Trump years, the Netanyahu and the Trump years, where Israelis really had the sense that they were invincible. I think for the first time in a long time, this kind of euphoria, this overwhelming support for Donald Trump, a president who was deeply unpopular for much of his presidency in the United States, who was impeached twice, the Israelis supported overwhelmingly this president because of the policies that he was backing, pro-annexation policies on Jerusalem, moving the embassy, just giving Israelis, I think the average Israeli, the sense that the most powerful country in the world not only has their back, because, you know, every U.S. administration for the past, you know, 50 years has done that, but really saying you can do whatever you want. It's not just that we'll ensure your existence, but you really have a free hand to do whatever the hell you want in this moment. And then the Biden administration comes in and tries to roll back some of the most kind of egregious policies, at least rhetorically, on Palestine that the Trump administration had been promoting for years. And then you have the violence, the war in May, this sense that things are changing and that Israelis need to be on guard again. They need to make sure that they are not vulnerable. And they really, I think, got used to this sense of invincibility. So just psychologically speaking, this is this remnant, this psychological remnant of 4 years of Trump and Netanyahu kind of doing whatever they needed to do.
Yeah, and I think it's quite telling that, prior to this current coalition government, we had Benjamin Netanyahu as the prime minister, who kind of created more and more right-wing coalitions as the years went by. And much of the association of this kind of this feeling of invincibility and this feeling that that the state can push as far as it wants to, both physically and in terms of discourse, for this kind of one state control, that was being led by Bibi, that was being led by the Likud party. But as we're just seeing in the past few months of this new coalition government and now this Ben and Jerry saga, is that you literally have, for example, a far-right prime minister, Naftali Bennett. You have what we could, again, in the Israeli political spectrum's terms, a center-right foreign minister, Yair Lapid. And you even have, like you said, Isaac Herzog, who used to be the head of the sort of center-left Labour Party. Now we could still define more as centrist, but essentially that even with these different Israeli figures, that same mentality that we want that free hand, we still believe that we have the right to continue asserting our presence in the territories, and that even if we have differences about it, that those international community cannot interfere in it. And so there's that continuity despite that change, and it really speaks a lot to how much these settlements are very much in the mainstream of Israeli political thought and Israeli social understanding. Now, this isn't, of course, new. I mean, the settlements themselves were initiated by a Labour government after 1967. They were supported throughout, even during the Rabin years and under Peres and the Oslo years. But it's very much, I think, a wake-up call for those who thought that the end of Bibi will sort of end this maximalist Israeli thinking. And here we're seeing quite evidence, even if it's performative or it's very substantive, that there's still a lot of continuity.
I mean, I think that there's something more complex at play here. And I'm really, really curious to hear what you think about this, because, there is this alignment, this kind of, okay, almost everyone is in on it, from the right and to the center left and to the Zionist left. It's unanimous in a rhetorical sense. Everyone is kind of towing that line. But when you look at the actual policies, there is something a little bit more complex, and this isn't me trying to defend the Israeli government, and neither Benjamin Netanyahu nor the new government, Naftali Bennett's government. But there is something a little bit complex at play here, because Bennett and Lapid recently agreed to accept money from the European Union, from a fund called Creative Europe, which gives money for arts and culture. And basically the EU stipulates that none of that money can go to West Bank settlements. And they came to some kind of agreement. This is something that Benjamin Netanyahu refused to take money from the EU for this project, specifically because it would block money to the settlements. But Bennett and Lapid came to some kind of agreement, some kind of compromise in which formally they would not recognize the EU's problems with the settlements, but would accept the money and stipulate that it does not go past 67 borders. So in a sense, they're also accepting these kind of stipulations. They themselves are saying, okay, when this kind of money will benefit Israel, we can accept a kind of a tacit boycott of the settlements. And I think this is just goes to show that, Israel wants to really turn a new page with the European Union after such a fraught relationship over the last few years. And so politically, they're kind of doing the opposite of what they're claiming to do rhetorically. Not to mention the fact that still legally, the West Bank is not annexed territory. It's not technically part of the State of Israel. The Bennett government has not said it is intending to annex the West Bank or any part of the Jewish settlements in the West Bank to Israel. Means that the West Bank is still technically under military occupation, and this actually, there is a distinction in the eyes of the Israeli government formally between occupied territory and Israel. So there's something interesting at play here, something that's like psychological, something that's rhetorical, and something that's just like on the ground, what's actually happening when it comes to Israel, you know, making policy. So I'm curious how you view that.
I mean, these technical differences are important. And like you say, you know, the way that ends up operating in the Israeli legal system, the military system, you know, these nuances are, you know, are important. But in a way, there's also a lot of continuity in this as well. There's always been this approach by the Israeli government to kind of play both sides. Even under Netanyahu, with the way that he would kind of present himself to the European Union, for example, and even the United States, you know, the whole idea of like, yeah, maybe we'll kind of consider a sort of two-state solution. Yes, we sort of kind of agree to these stipulations that you have. The Israeli government has always tried to play these two sides. But in the end, you know, the same policy on the ground is continuing. And these technical nuances, you know, while they're certainly important, they still achieve the same objective. You know, we talk about this a lot, even with like the Israeli legal system, that you have civil law operating in, you know, inside the kind of what we call like the pre-1967 borders within the state and against Palestinian citizens, for example, versus the military laws in the territories. And there's certainly different severities and mechanisms and so on, but the goal is the same. And so this is why this idea that the Israeli establishment is also is like there's a reason why they're doing this. And in the end, the result turns out being the same continuity of policy of entrenching the occupation, entrenching a regime of apartheid, and deliberately, oftentimes confusing, deliberately trying to obscure the understandings of the international community of exactly what's going on. They want people to get wrapped up in the complexities. They want people to get wrapped up in those technical nuances. And the Europeans especially fall for this consistently. And so this is why we have to kind of sort of, you know, sift aside the BS and boil down to that same essential policy. And this is, I think, is what's, it's kind of like keep your eye on the ball, per se.
So when you think about the Ben and Jerry's decision, I mean, I think a lot of listeners and readers out there just kind of want to understand, like, what is the significance of this moment politically for Israel and in general? Like, is this symbolic? Will it have any material effect? Is it okay that it's just symbolic? Maybe it's a symbolic victory that's important. Where do you see that?
I think it's pretty safe to say that this is almost entirely symbolic. I'm not even sure Ben and Jerry's is the most popular ice cream in Israel as it is. But it's an important moment, but less so for the people here, I think, as it is for the people outside. I think many Israelis are already kind of wrapped up in the idea that the world is going to be against us no matter what, whether we have the occupation or not. And so there is kind of like something they'll just kind of shrug off their shoulders, that the politicians will make a fuss about it and then they'll carry on. And that's most likely what's going to happen. It is important, though, and the responses that are coming out of here, even if it's kind of shrugged off by most Israelis, it's important for people abroad to pay attention to these reactions, because there's still this assumption, and especially again post-Netanyahu, that Israel will kind of change its course, that it will sort of see the benefits of ending the occupation, of stopping settlement funding, and so on and so forth. These reactions should be a very, very clear message to people abroad that that is not going to happen, that the state is going to continue entrenching its regime of apartheid, that the Israeli politicians don't want anyone outside to think of the settlements as differently from the state. And this is important for those, especially who and this is especially among sort of like liberal Zionist camps who try to sort of set a very clear division between like, you know, the Israeli state and the settlements. But here you have the establishment from across the political spectrum saying, no, we do not see it any differently. And so there needs to be less of this kind of apology, not only by, you know, among the liberal Zionist camps, but also people like the European Union, like the United States, who keep pretending, even though the Israeli politicians are literally saying, we do not see them as separate. It's like, no, you see them as separate. Like, they cannot be this sort of, these apologists for the Israeli establishment. And so this moment itself is a tiny footnote. But but it is part of a larger pattern that should increase the consciousness, and I hope it's increasing the consciousness of people to understand exactly how the system here works, what exactly it's thinking, and that it cannot continue on the same course of just allowing Israel to do what it wishes and perceive the occupied territories as it wishes, and that there needs to be pushback. Even if that starts literally with an ice cream company, that symbolic moment is important. It is a wake-up call.
I think kind of, you know, liberal Zionist groups, you know, J Street put out a statement, Americans for Peace Now put out a statement celebrating this and, you know, celebrating it alongside a lot of other Palestinian groups. But it almost seemed like they were celebrating it for a very, very different reason. They're saying, no, this is not only what we're committed to as organizations, but what Israel is nominally committed to, you know, as part of the peace process, part of Oslo and endless kind of peace process and peace negotiations. It almost feels like that celebration is flies in the face of the shrinking space for liberal Zionist thought today. You know, in Israel, it's almost completely gone. The left-wing Zionist groups or Zionist parties like Meretz and Labor, they hardly talk about the occupation. They really will try to focus on anything else today rather than, you know, what traditionally the Zionist left in Israel, the liberal Zionists in Israel have focused on. In the United States, it's almost like it's unclear to me where liberal Zionism goes from here. I mean, it's been unclear to us for a long time, but the celebration is almost seems odd to me. Like, I'm glad that this thing is happening, and I'm glad that they're happy that it's happening, but the conclusion almost seems like we'll reach the same conclusion every time, even though reality keeps pushing back on us.
This is actually the second question I wanted to kind of, you know, dissect out of this whole saga. I'm curious, though, what you've been seeing, you know, among the American Jewish community, you know, over this past week. Like, what have you observed between sort of like some of the main establishment groups that you've mentioned? I know there was also recently a poll that kind of had some very revealing insights about American Jews, and especially young American Jews, and their shifting opinions on Israel-Palestine. How have you seen this whole Ben and Jerry saga fit into all this in the past week and these past years, of course?
I mean, that poll is so interesting in this moment, right? 25% of American Jews call Israel an apartheid state. I think 19% are now willing to say what Israel is doing is genocide. And I think 34% liken the treatment of Palestinians by Israel to African-American folks in the United States. Now, these numbers are pretty incredible. You know, they're stark. I think that when those numbers came out a few weeks ago, everyone just kind of shook their head in disbelief, or I'm sure a lot of people shook their head in anger, but you know, certainly my friends, my colleagues, kind of people on the left, Jews on the left, were struck by those numbers, and it flies, those numbers fly in the face of a lot of what we're seeing among kind of Jewish establishment organizations that have really adopted a hardline approach when it comes to Israel. And in a lot of ways, you know, what I've been seeing over the past few years is that far-right Zionism, not just Zionism as this kind of concept, you know, that we can talk about in all of its complexity and what it means to American Jews, and, you know, the far-right version of Zionism, almost the messianic version of Zionism, has become kind of a core component of American Judaism and Judaism around the world. And that's a really kind of sad and scary development. And this huge gap between that kind of rhetoric and this rhetoric that's, you know, become much more part of the establishment. You look at the young American Jews who are using the word apartheid, or using the word genocide, whatever, you know, one's take is on those terms, or likening it to anti-Black racism. This huge divide is like, we're reaching this breaking point, if you ask me. And the question of who do these establishment figures and the people who have adopted this, you know, fundamentalist Zionist worldview, who do they represent in the United States? Who do these establishments represent? Who do these organizations represent today? It's hard to say, But I'm really, really, you know, I'm hopeful. I'm really, really hopeful. Those numbers made me extremely hopeful. But that divide is something that I'm really, really curious about. I'm really, really looking forward to kind of understanding what that means, actually. I don't have a fully formed thought about it. Amjad, there's this kind of discussion that's been happening, again, like on social media, but a worthy discussion about whether this Ben & Jerry's decision is a victory for BDS, whether it's even, you know, part of the BDS movement. There's, you know, people who are defending it and saying it's not part of BDS. It's just, you know, this is compliance with international law. Other people who are saying this is a harbinger of things to come for the BDS movement and in general for the Palestine rights movement in the United States. So I'm wondering, what is the significance for this for organizers abroad, particularly in the United States, and for the Palestine movement in general? Where do you see this heading?
I mean, the first thing I think that needs to be sort of put on the table is to understand why boycott, divestment, and sanctions exists in the first place. Like, it's very much a symptom, and it's a manifestation of a bigger demand. And that demand, of course, is for Palestinian rights, for Palestinian freedoms, to be able to use a historic, nonviolent, almost civil disobedience as well campaign, an international campaign, to achieve those rights. This is hardly unprecedented in history. It's very well known in the United States. But this is how, like, BDS needs to be understood as one method of that. And it's trying to achieve this sort of sense of accountability, and it's literally grounding its principles under international law. Like, one of the things that BDS does is to try to encourage companies, whether directly or indirectly, to pull any investments that they make in occupied territories as international law dictates.
Right.
Like, it's, you know, in any other situation, this is kind of a basic demand, but because this is relating to Israel, because suddenly the issue becomes complicated. You know, at best, you're having people say that, you know, BDS is kind of this dangerous or harmful sort of movement. And then you, on the extreme end, you have people who are saying this is outright anti-Semitism, and that even President Herzog was calling this as a form of economic terrorism. And it speaks very much to how the Israeli establishment cannot tolerate any form of resistance from Palestinians and their allies. There's, of course, the, you know, the natural opposition to any form of armed struggle or violence of any sorts.
Yeah.
But then, as we're seeing with even something as boycott or divestment, that this is also being considered a form of terrorism, that this is being considered a form of violence, and it's being considered a form of racism. And everything in between is essentially absolutely intolerable. Now, of course, this kind of opposition is going to be expected by a state that's occupying, that's imposing this regime, that's keeping Palestinians suppressed deliberately for a very clear kind of supremacist ideology. But the fact that so many people, especially in the United States, are buying into that, that yes, a nonviolent act, which is protected by the First Amendment, which we revere, for example, in the civil rights movement in India, with South Africa, even in, like, you know, union strikes, like, these are basic principles of nonviolent resistance, and even this is unacceptable. And so here we're seeing American politicians, both in Congress and on the state levels, and governors passing all kinds of forms of legislation to essentially criminalize, for all intents and purposes, the right to carry out boycotts or pull out any investments from Israel, and specifically from Israeli settlements. And we're seeing this now, whereby literally in the past week, the Israeli top officials have basically openly said, we are calling on governors and state legislatures to apply those laws against Ben & Jerry's.
A number of them are already starting to look into that.
Exactly. And this is extremely concerning. Now, thankfully, because of the immense, like, grassroots and civil rights work that's going on there, many of these laws and attempted efforts to kind of punish Palestine advocates for, you know, either promoting BDS or even just tolerating BDS, a lot of these have been struck down as unconstitutional. But there's a very deliberate purpose behind this. It's to intimidate Palestine advocates. It's to intimidate any companies like Ben & Jerry's, which say that we don't want to contribute to settlements. I hear it's important to note that Ben & Jerry's in a statement said that we're still continuing to operate and sell our ice cream in, you know, in Israel's exactly. official state borders.
Right.
It's only about the, it's primarily about the occupied territory, which BDS also insists on. Like, it's very clear about where it wants to pull out of, where it wants companies to pull out their investments. But this just cannot be accepted. So it's very alarming that that there's an entire infrastructure now designed to ensure that not only that people can oppose these decisions by the Israeli state, but essentially to encage Palestine and their allies, to prevent them from being able to even speak up about not just about Israel's policies, but to even dare to say that there's a distinction between the settlements and the state. This is very alarming.
It is wild to me that, you know, you have this BDS movement that has been pretty severely hit over the last few years by the Trump administration, basically by these chilling effects. And it has never reached the level of power or momentum that the anti-BDS movement has reached in the United States, where, you know, really like anti-Palestinianism. Of course, Peter Beinart wrote a piece about this in Jewish Currents last week. Like, anti-Palestinianism is a central tenet of the Republican Party and many politicians in the United States. It just blows my mind the degree to which really just bigotry translated into the attempt to suffocate free speech is normalized against Palestinians.
Right. And unfortunately, it's not just the Republican Party, like so many members of the Democratic Party from Congress all the way down. They are among the sponsors of these kind of anti-BDS laws. They are among the prime instigators of this kind of rhetoric against Palestinians. And, you know, that term anti-Palestinianism, you know, there's no like clear definition of the term, but you can see how much it just permeates so much of the American discourse. And it's, of course, at the core of all kind of Israeli policies here, you know, to try to assert its own state and to assert the supremacy of Jewish rights over Palestinians, and you know these anti-BDS laws are among them. You know, the idea that you can demonize the right to boycott when it's used by Palestinians, that is a form of anti-Palestinianism. When you're saying that the settlements on occupied Palestinian land is, you know, to call that out is a form of anti-Semitism. That itself is a form of anti-Palestinianism. The anti-Semitism definitions that have been popping up, especially the one promoted by the IHRA, which is being accepted and integrated by parliaments and even the United States.
Corporations.
Exactly, yeah. They're applying these guidelines, which basically, you know, for all intents and purposes, it's basically saying to be a Palestinian is inherently to be anti-Semitic.
Right.
Like, I can't put it more bluntly. Like, the very fact that anyone even dares to critique Israel defining itself as a Jewish state, as an ethno-national religious state, which is built on the ruins of an entire nation and society and is still, you know, continuing to perpetuate those ruins, that to even call that out makes you a racist, is a form of anti-Palestinianism.
Yeah, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, this far-right version of Zionism being adopted as a central tenet of a component of Judaism today, that sees any form of Palestinianism, really any form of Palestinianism that doesn't say, you know, that doesn't say we give up, we have no claims to anything, we're just living here peacefully, we don't want to bother you, we don't want to challenge you, we don't want to do anything, we're good Israeli Arabs, or we just want to live in peace. So anything that really slightly diverts from that is suddenly called anti-Semitism, and that is a central, that's become just like so central to the discourse in Israel and to the discourse in the United States, particularly among the right and some segments of you know the Democratic Party, and that's a terrifying thing to watch.
Yeah, and just to kind of bring a bit of, you know, a personal angle to this, to wake up, you know, to go through every week and to hear these kind of attempts to completely crush any assertion of Palestinian identity or solidarity, it's really harrowing. Like, it's, there is this constant feeling, and even with something as simple as an ice cream company, you know, and the saga that's been going on this past week, it feels like this really global attempt to completely erase you, to erase your very being, to erase your essence, your identity. It's like, we will never accept or tolerate you as a Palestinian. And there's something so ghastly about it. There's something really sinister. And, you know, and there are even these kind of people who think of themselves as well-intentioned, and those who are portraying, you know, if you're putting aside your kind of your far rightist or your racist or the ones who are doing this for very sort of heinous reasons, and even those who kind of identify themselves as liberals and saying, no, things like BDS or pulling out of settlements right now or not going to a negotiated solution, you know, this is very harmful, it's very dangerous, you know, they're portraying it in these ways. But by doing so, they're basically falling back onto the current power dynamic, which it literally is erasure of Palestinians on the ground and erasure of Palestinians in thought. The very idea that our identity exists terrifies people. It angers people. It enrages state authorities, you know, from the top to the bottom. And it's very stifling. And even with that kind of like very choking environment and that very harrowing environment, you know, it's incredible to see that the Palestine movement in the US is still growing exponentially. And this is not just the incredible work that's being done by grassroots activists, by civil rights lawyers, by people, you know, really trying to push beyond, you know, push the boundaries of discourse and conversation in multiple countries in solidarity with Palestinians. But I got to say, also, the Israeli officials, as we saw this past week, are doing a lot of our work for us.
Yeah, they do the job.
Yeah, they're giving like primary evidence as to what the state is thinking, what the Israeli political establishment is thinking. And this is, again, why, you know, this is why we're literally dedicating an entire episode to this Ben and Jerry's, you know, thing, which looks ridiculous, but it tells us so much. And this is the message that we have to keep pushing through, even if it comes through with, like, literally like an ice cream cone. Like, it's to make people understand where this anti-Palestinianism is coming from. What is the purpose? What is the intent? And that the intent is full impunity for Israel and full erasure of Palestinians. That message needs to be honed in. And for, you know, Americans and Europeans, whether you're a policymaker or an activist on the ground, the quicker you grasp that reality, the quicker you understand and accept that this is precisely the mission, then that means that there has to be action. It means that there has to be consequences. There has to be repercussions. And you can, you know, we have Ben and Jerry's doing this, but we had, for example, Airbnb doing this before. More and more companies are starting to question and debate whether or not we should be contributing to this kind of system and this regime. As even Yair Lapid said, the thing in front of the Europeans last week, that I may be a two-statist, but as far as I'm concerned, we're staying here for the long term. That message really needs to be absorbed.
I want to ask one last question before we go, about momentum. You mentioned Airbnb. And Airbnb was a really, really interesting and important test case because they decided they weren't going to do business in the settlements anymore. And they announced it, you know, they went with it. And they got such tremendous blowback that they actually reneged on their decision and continued to do business in the occupied territories. The folks over at Ben and Jerry's saw that. You know, they know the story. They've studied it. They know about the blowback. And they decided to do it anyway. They decided that this was something that, you know, as they say, the hill they were going to die on. They did that. What do you make of that when you think about, like, momentum and momentum for the Palestine movement globally? And, you know, making sure corporations do, especially ones that claim to be progressive like Ben and Jerry's, we hold their feet to the fire and they do comply with basic international law and, you know, just the sense of fairness and justness. How do we think about that?
The first thing we have to do is kind of be humble about what it means to build a movement. Whether we look at, you know, the civil rights movement in the U.S. or even the, you know, the boycott movement against apartheid South Africa, and even beyond the boycott movement there, These things take many years. They take many small victories, and oftentimes it feels very unclear where it's heading. And there's always backlash. There's always pushback. You know, this is the nature of the struggle. And so, you know, we have to understand that this is a very long game to play. And, you know, this is time that effectively will always be incurred on the Palestinians. It's not just their loss of time. It's their loss of land. It's their loss of livelihood. It's loss of lives. But we also need to understand that, you know, the history of the world tells us that these processes have to go forward. With that said, it's when we do have little moments like this, when we do have little victories like this, it's important that those who make those decisions, those companies that make these decisions, that they stay their course. That they understand that this is a movement that is trying to achieve real justice. And even if it feels hard in the moment, it plays a huge part in the long term. And we saw this even just in the past few years, for example, with American Jews stepping out to kind of push back against their own establishment to question Israel and to speak up on Palestine. We saw this with Black American activists who, you know, were really kind of, you know, targeted for speaking out on Palestine in recent years. But they stayed their course. And this, of course, was also with Palestinians who, you know, are the first and foremost to be subjected to these kind of attacks. But to see them organizing and mobilizing in ways that they couldn't have done before, all that is having impact. And it's hard for us to see that 5 years ago, but it's clear for us to see it now. Even though, for example, Airbnb sort of backtracked, it was clear that it provided lessons. And it's clear that Ben & Jerry's took those lessons. And the main thing is just to keep applauding it. It's to keep pumping it up. And, you know, even if something happens to Ben & Jerry's, which I hope it won't, but like if these anti-BDS laws are applied, then that means that the, you know, resistance to that kind of suppression needs to increase. And there's a huge infrastructure that's being built in the United States to, you know, to defend that. And it's about mobilizing more people. And it's happening. It's happening both in sort of direct ways through the movement and also by those who are witnessing more and more that if this is the way that Israel and Israelis are choosing to go, there's little space left for America to kind of wiggle out of it and to say that, oh, we do have a responsibility. And Ben & Jerry's is a sign that we're doing something right. It may not be as fast as we want it to be. You know, it's a very frustrating process. It's a very tiny, you know, aspect of life here in Israel-Palestine, but it means that we're doing something right. And that movement will continue to evolve. The strategies will continue. But I think Palestine advocates and any advocate for freedom and justice for all here, savor this moment. It is something to cherish because it means that, okay, we can keep getting these little wins. And in the end, the bigger impact is not whether or not there's ice cream in the Israeli settlements, but that Americans and the world start to realize what really needs to be done in order to make a real change here in Israel-Palestine.
Amjad, it's so rare that we get to have these kind of optimistic conversations in a place that doesn't give us much room for optimism, much reason for optimism. So I'm really, really glad that we got to sit down and chat. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Same here, man. Grab an ice cream?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. Why not? This episode was produced by myself, Amjad Iraqi, and Henriette Shakan. Thanks so much.
Get an ice cream!
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
it takes a good dose of courage and perseverance to get through a pandemic.
True, but it also takes a good dose of patience, resilience, confidence, optimism, humor, and love. Not to mention a dose of determination, endurance, empathy, motivation, hope, and ingenuity.
But above all, it takes a second dose of vaccine.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
The way